Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Town, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds...
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Town and Gene DiNardo on this Thursday, January 12, 2012. And here are some of the headlines we're looking at today. From overseas, the EU got a little bit of a respite today when successful bond sales were made for both Italy and Spain, actually over the last couple days. Meanwhile, in Iran, nuclear fuel rods continue to be an issue, as do questions about the killing of a nuclear scientist. The EU is also perhaps facing up to a potential oil embargo as a result of possible war. Here in the United States, Americans continue to extend their credit cards, just like old times. And, of course, the big news this past week was Mitt Romney winning the New Hampshire primary with Ron Paul coming in a solid second. And I figured we should probably take a minute or two just to talk about that before we get into the major headlines. Guys, I'm not sure what your take on it is. It looks to me like the overall field in the Republican primaries are going to be rather fluid for quite some time. It looks to me that Romney is going to be considered the front runner. It also looks to me that Ron Paul, at least for the time being, is going to be solid number two. What do you guys think? Gene, let's go to you first.
I think it's been that way all along with the GOP machine, you know, just hoping that this all these contenders that came up for a couple weeks and challenged Romney, I think they were just hoping they would fade away as they have. And it's really interesting because Ron Paul is the more consistent candidate and has pushed his numbers up a bit, and he's a strong second, and I think he'll probably stay there. It's hard, maybe not in this. What's the next one? Is South Carolina?
South Carolina next, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I've read that that's going to be a tough one for him because of his stand on defense, and it's a big defense state. They get tons of welfare money from the government for defense. And
what do you think, Jake? You got the same take, or you have a different idea?
Slightly different. I think that Ron Paul was kind of a surprise in the field, coming in, second in Iowa since the other two were tied for first, and second in New Hampshire. I think that was relatively unexpected if you look back even like a month, and I think that he has quite a bit of momentum because Romney was kind of expected to win it, or Gingrich, and Gingrich has faded away, Perry has faded away, Bachman has dropped out. Santorum was also a bit of a surprise in Iowa. Not a good one from my perspective, and he probably should do okay in some parts of the South, like a little bit of some parallels between the Huckabee candidacy in the 2008 and Santorum's rise so far. He might do very well in South Carolina, but I think after that, it's kind of an open race, and I think that there's a long road ahead. There's plenty of room for Romney to slip up, and there's all the chances in the world for Ron Paul supporters to kind of pull together and hopefully get a few W's later on. So, and that's something that I'm pretty optimistic at this point after being fairly realistic in how he would do in the past, and I think that that's something our guest, Robin Corner, will be able to highlight a little bit more about, since one of the interesting things was Ron Paul also finished second in the Democratic primary in New Hampshire. He got the second highest number of votes after, of course, Barack Obama, but he wasn't even on the ballot. 2,000 people wrote in Ron Paul, while 49,000 people picked Barack Obama in that state. So I think that also says something in terms of the cross the aisle, or really just the other party type of appeal. So we'll have to see how things go. South Carolina is coming up, I think, is it at the end of the month? When is that primary date?
I think it's in about a week and a half, but it's coming up soon.
Do you guys see any possibility of Paul going for a third party?
I don't myself. What do you think?
No, I don't think there's zero chance of that. And really, if you just have to hear what he's saying, he's also saying there's zero chance of that because he has such a great chance at the Republican nomination. He's pretty much gone almost to the point of saying never, but again, didn't say never. So I think it's probably a pretty low probability at this point. And I think that realistically speaking, he's trying to build a liberty movement. He's giving up not running for re-election in his House seat in Texas. So I think that his focus is on just kind of building up a groundswell that his 2008 presidential campaign really kind of started.
Well, it's interesting because there's media talk about that, and that they talk about whatever they want, so it makes sense that he hasn't said anything about it. But when they talk about it, they say that if he did, he would make a big dent in the Republican side as far as votes. But it's funny because, like you mentioned, the Democrats had voted for him when he wasn't on the ballot. I think he would do the same on the Democrat side. I mean, a lot of Democrats would vote for him in a third party, I think.
And we saw both in New Hampshire and Iowa that Paul is by far the strongest of the candidates with independent voters. I mean, in New Hampshire, I think he was like 20 points ahead of Romney among independents. It was a major, major difference. The other thought that comes to my mind is that I think it's, like Jake said, I think it's really unlikely that Ron Paul would run in a third party. I think probably close to zero. But the one scenario I can think of where Ron Paul could decide to go third party is if the plan that the Paul campaign has is to go to the Republican convention and have a brokered convention with nobody coming into the convention with enough votes to be nominated so that he can try to do his thing, maneuver his way perhaps to a nomination or at least to some sort of powerful position to where he can help broker the thing. If it turns out that that convention ends up alienating a large segment, perhaps even the largest segment of the Ron Paul support, it's possible that a draft Ron Paul as a third-party candidate could emerge. But I would put that as a very, very low possibility, certainly less than 5%.
I think it's extremely low, and the reason for that is the Republican convention, correct me if I'm wrong, is sometime in like either late August or early September. And if that were to happen at that point, there's no spot for him to get onto a ballot. I'm sure people could write in, but
He'd have to get a third-party nomination without his support at some point before that. You're right.
Oh, that's a complication. Another thing that we haven't really mentioned is the Internet Party, and I forget the name of it, and it's going to be interesting who they pick, and they're doing it all on the Internet and organizing everything through Internet votes, so that's going to be interesting too.
Well, also, one of the major issues that Ron Paul has long championed, and one that, of course, we talk about here on the Freedom News Hour, is the monetary and banking system. And of late, the major plays have been over in Europe. Yesterday and today, the auctions for Italian and Spanish debt were held, and they did surprisingly well. So it has given a boost to the market, although a smaller one than I might have expected. The market in both Europe and in the U.S., they were up, but not dramatically up. And Jake, I'm wondering, what's your take on that? Are the markets actually wising up to what's happening with the financial crisis, or is it just that they'd already factored it in?
Could you say that again? There was a dog running by.
Sure, no problem. You got to pay attention to the broadcast.
No, I'm serious.
No, I was just asking you about the auction for the Italian and Spanish debt that was held yesterday. And the results were very positive for the two sovereign states selling their debt. They actually did better than most analysts expected, and yet the response by the markets today had been rather tepid by comparison. So I'm wondering, what do you think? Is this the market showing that they're wising up to what's happening and how serious the situation is, or was it already just priced into what they had done previously?
Well, the whole thing is that what the European Central Bank is doing is a major bailout, and they already announced the LTRO bailout plan, which took place already, and will again take. There'll be another offering in February, and to make a long story short, what that does is it's loans that encourages the European banks to go out and buy sovereign debt. Then use that as the collateral for future loans, say in February. So I think it's no surprise that they're able to sell the bonds at whatever rates. but I think that, you know, at the end of the day, it's very inflationary, but it's also trying to prop up the system and keep it going, very similar to, in effect, what the U.S. did with the quantitative easing program. There's massive amounts of money being handled through that, and you know, I think that the markets are figuring this stuff out. Although, again, since it's inflationary, it's not necessarily a negative for the stock market, because in terms of purchasing power, you know, if the purchasing power of the euro is going down, then if the, you know, the market capitalization of the company stays the same, then the stock market is actually going to go up.
And that's what really caught my attention. That's exactly what caught my attention, because normally, like you say, I would expect the stock market to have a big boost out of this kind of thing, because they usually get, you know, yahoo about the inflation. That generally means more money coming into market, more, you know, potential future buyers. They'll buy the stock now. But that's not what they're doing, and that's the interesting thing. It almost goes contrary to what stock markets patterns have been over, say, the last 3 or 4 years, particularly since the financial crisis hit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of things going on today. Like, I think later on the show, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about oil. Oil is up just right around $100 a barrel these days, but you have a lot of stuff going on around the Straits of Hormuz and Iran, which certainly adds a bit of instability to a already pretty fragile system.
Well, we've got a few minutes before we go to the break and then bring Robin on to talk about Blue Democrats. Why don't you just give us the update on what's happening with the EU and with Iran, because there's actually a couple stories going on there.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. To make a long story short, the United States has had an embargo on Iran for years and years and years and years. What's going on right now is that the U.S. is bringing even more pressure onto all other nations to boycott Iran's oil. They appear to have success with the EU, although there's some news coming out today that the EU is saying that they're going to be delaying the imports of Iranian oil for about 6 months to allow Greece, Italy, and Spain, the weaker countries, to find alternative supplies. Japan just kind of came on board, again, kind of slowly. They said, yeah, we can't turn it off right away, but we'll kind of go on that. So the U.S. is using all of our diplomatic power to place an embargo over a country. And, again, the whole premise is similar to Iraq. Oh, they have nuclear weapons. And the highlights that hit the news wires last week were based on that nuclear fuel rods have been developed. However, when you go in per Bloomberg, almost anybody that you ask, the U.S. analysis says that this has a diplomatic significance, but it has no military significance really whatsoever, since these parts can't be used for missiles. But what was interesting was the headlines said they're very skewed, almost like the war propaganda that we hear about from wars past. And the headlines, a lot of them that I saw was Iran completes nuclear fuel rod, fires test missile, and the test missile was a conventional weapon, not related at all to nuclear fuel rod. And they're just kind of combining these news events to make it sound like, you know, they're getting ready to launch nuclear missiles, which they're not. The International Atomic and Energy Association, they will be visiting the country in late January, in a couple weeks. But again, Iran has had the most surprise visits by the international organization, and they have found nothing. There is nothing there. A car bomb, I think it was either yesterday or several days ago, a car bomb detonated, killing a 32-year-old nuclear scientist. Rumors are that Israel was involved with that. Iran is engaging in military exercises in the Straits of Hormuz. There was a slight break, kind of good news, there was a slight break last week in the U.S.-Iranian tensions since the U.S. captured a vessel taken over by Somalian pirates that was piloted by Iranians and returned the Iranians to Iran. And Iran, for once, said thank you very, very much. Every nation should be acting in such a way. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're right back to kind of where we started. People have kind of forgotten about that. And I think that today Iran called on the United Nations to condemn the nuclear scientist killing. And this is just leading to no good end. I think that the United States is being led into a war that has really very little grounding in fact. The CIA studies, you know, that we've had for years have said that the evidence was that they did have a nuclear energy program at one point, but it stopped it. And this, you know, the international community is kind of obeying the United States, but very, very slowly to kind of see what's going to happen. And it's, again, it's just not good. Like you know, when to put it in perspective for Americans, like when the British blockaded our ports back during the Revolutionary War, we went to war. It was an act of war, and we were committing an act of war against a sovereign nation without a declaration of war. So it's pretty normal for the United States. We did it in Iraq. We did it in Afghanistan.
That was actually the second nuclear scientist that's been killed, isn't it? Wasn't it? Or
I'm only aware of one, but there could very well be others in the past.
I thought I heard that in the news last night.
Well, that heartening news, let's take a quick break because our guest is ready for us, and after the break we'll have Robin Corner talk to us about Blue Democrats. It's going to be very interesting. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Run back to your dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, and we have a special guest with us today. Jake's going to introduce him. Jake.
Hello. We have Robin Corner, a reporter for the Huffington Post, with us today. Are you there, Robin?
I am, Jake. Good to be with you.
Hey, thanks for joining us again. For our listeners, Robin was responsible for coining the term Blue Republican for independents and Democrats who are temporarily registering as Republicans to vote for Ron Paul in the 2012 GOP primary in order to promote policies that Barack Obama was elected on but failed to deliver, to stop the wars abroad, to stop torture, to close Guantanamo Bay, to end the Patriot Act, and stop the corporatist bailouts. There have been thousands of likes on the Facebook page, and we'd like to ask him a few questions about this. So, Robin, what's your take so far on the primary results in New Hampshire and Iowa?
Well, I guess like many people who feel like I do politically, I was a little disappointed in Iowa, but I was kind of happy in New Hampshire. I think like Ron Paul, I'm excited about the big picture. I think we're close to critical mass, if we're not already there, in terms of changing the political nature of this country. I'm still very much fighting and enthusiastic for a Ron Paul win. I do think it's possible. I think there's a lot to be said for the argument that this really is a two-man race, especially with only Romney and Paul on the ballot in every state of the nation. And there are lots of things not to like about Romney, especially if you don't like what Obama has done to this country. So I'm quietly confident and optimistic.
Well, that's good to hear. And I'm not sure if you had heard earlier, but I mentioned that Ron Paul actually also got the second highest.
Yes.
Well, finished second in the Democrat New Hampshire primary with 2,000 write-in votes, and while Barack Obama got 49,000. So it was kind of a significant number.
Absolutely. You know, this speaks exactly to what I'm all about in my writing, this idea of phase change, this idea of breaking down the old tired paradigm of left and right, Democrats, Republicans, donkeys and elephants. Americans are starting to work out that left and right together have brought America to its current crisis, that they actually agree on most of what matters, all the things that you mentioned before, Jake, you know, the civil rights problems, the undeclared wars, the corporate cronyism. So as that knowledge kind of seeps through the consciousness of the American voter, we're going to see more very exciting things like you know, Ron Paul's coming second in the Democratic primary. I think this is just the beginning.
That's good to hear. And speaking of civil liberties, I was reading a recent article of yours that was titled America Wins the War on Terror, 9/11 to 12/1 of 2011. And in the article, you're writing about the National Defense Authorization Act for the year 2012. And I just want to... I had a selection of it picked out, but I was wondering if you could tell us about this, I guess, somewhat sarcastic article.
Yeah, you know, actually, one of my main reasons for writing this article was that the only article that I have ever written for the Huffington Post that they refused to publish was an attempt to publicize the Department of Defense financed study into suicide terrorism.
Really?
That determined that 95% of suicide terrorism, which is 12 times more dangerous than any other kind of terrorism, is actually perpetrated by people against those who they believe are present in territory that they have a claim to or is their homeland. So even those people that we in the U.S. are labeled Islamo-fascists who want to kill us for our freedom, it turns out they don't come and they don't try and kill us with suicide bombs for our freedom. They only come and kill us when we're in their home. Or some version thereof. And that's been the case for suicide terrorism since it started in the 1980s against all victims of suicide terrorism. You know, if you look at the Tamil Tigers, whatever, it's always been territorially driven independently of the ideology of the perpetrators of the suicide terrorism. And I wrote an article about that. It was really quite factual, discussing this Department of Defense study. And Huffington Post just refused to publish it. And I was like, this is extraordinary. So, I mean, I say a lot of things on the rather leftist site, Huffington Post, that are against the leftist sitting president. And they let me post all of them. But when I kind of took down our foreign policy, arguably from the left, some would say that didn't get through. So I needed kind of some other way to get that fact out there.
Robin, I'm curious, what was their reason? Did they give any reason at all for refusing to publish that?
I sent 8 emails to at least 3 people asking that exact question at the Huffington Post, and not one of them was responded to.
Really?
And yes, and then the next email that I sent about something completely different, they responded to as if I'd never even written or mentioned the article.
Wow. You touched a button there somewhere.
Right, and I think it's important to highlight for our listeners what Robin said. You know, it's not just the United States with Iraq or the United States with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's really with like the Sri Lankan ongoing war with the Tamil Tigers, and it's all in a book that Dr. Robert Pape wrote titled Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And it's just as he said, it's a very factual study. He just compiled all the attacks. He looked at all the details on the people that were actually committing the bombings as well as the group, and it's kind of the conclusion is that the suicide terrorism is kind of a last-ditch effort by groups where their country is being invaded, number one, and number two, they don't have any way of really fighting back other than this. And when you're desperate to protect your homeland, this is the type of stuff that occurs. So it's very good that you point that out, and it was also great to see that recent article that did end up getting published by the Huffington Post a few weeks ago.
Whilst I smuggled that Robert Pape study, which I should say, funding by our own Department of Defense, these are government statistics. These are not the statistics of some, anti-war leftist. This is what our government has determined by spending millions of dollars. But the actual article that you mentioned, and thanks for mentioning it, Jake, I was really to make the point that obviously if the powers that be in this country are right that these terrorists want to kill us for our freedoms, then it makes complete sense that the one way of winning the war and stopping making ourselves safe against these terrorists, is to eliminate the very thing that is causing them to attack us, which is, by their logic, our freedoms. So by the logic of our congressmen and our senators, we have won the war on terrorism by making us safe, by eliminating the very freedoms that cause other people to want to attack us. So well done, political leaders of the United States. It's an absolute disgrace.
At the risk of the final takedown
of the Bill of Rights.
At the risk of getting into a discussion about some sort of political conspiracy theory, where does 9/11 fit into this overall theory that you outlined in the article?
Oh, I just used 9/11 as the start date of the war on terror because that was really, I think, the event that initiated the widespread use of the phrase war on terror, which of course is absurd.
Right, but I'm referring to what you described in terms of the motivations of the people who were involved in all these suicide attacks, and that seems to me to be the mother of all suicide attacks, so I'm wondering what conclusions you draw about what happened with 9/11.
Oh, well, Robert Pape, pointed out the fact that the hijackers of those planes, the perpetrators of that attack, were from Saudi Arabia, the country where the Americans have put their troops in, actually going back to the first Iraq War, and left them. The Muslims there perceive that we are infidels on their territory, and whatever they think about us religiously, we do have military assets, and this is the important point of the Department of Defense study, that it's military assets that are on the ground that drive suicide terrorism. The terrorists in this case were from Saudi Arabia. There are many other nations where you have Islamic fundamentalism, where America is in the West are not liked, but we are not attacked from those nations by this means of this tactic of suicide terrorism, which is the most dangerous kind. So if you look at the Sudan, if you look at Iran or these other countries that we have problems with, we have not been victims of the same kind of attack as 9/11 because we're not in those countries, whereas we are in Saudi Arabia. Does that make sense?
Some sense, although we do certainly have military installations in countries around the world, so I think the analogy starts to fall apart on that ground a little bit.
The point here is that the presence of our military assets is not a sufficient condition for the attack, but it's a 95% necessary condition for suicide terrorism. So to put it the other way, the best way that the U.S. government have identified of stopping our being the victims of suicide terrorism is to remove our military assets from countries where we are not wanted. That's
right,
important.
And to kind of highlight what Walt was going after with 9/11, like if you look at Saudi Arabia, the Khobar Tower bombings was directed at a housing for U.S. Military forces. And that occurred in 1996, and it still took till 2001, 2002 for us to withdraw our troops. But it's just a tactic that's used to kind of in this case remove troops from the Holy Land that are not wanted there. And it's the same thing kind of going on in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And switching gears just a little bit, Robin, I was wondering if you could give us your take on all of the recent events surrounding Iran with the oil embargo, the nuclear scientist getting blown up in a car bomb, et cetera, et cetera. What's your take on Iran?
Yeah, I'm still trying to catch up with what's kind of going on here. I was a little out of the loop over Christmas and New Year, visiting family in the UK. But, one thing I know is that the Iranians are making quite a logical, if they are pursuing this nuclear weapon, then that's quite a logical thing to be doing. If they look at the world and they want to see what makes a country be taken seriously by the United States and by the West, certainly having a nuke will help. Let's be clear that Iran is surrounded by American military bases, and yet here we are telling the story that we're threatened by them. They are threatened by us, and whatever the will of Ahmadinejad and his cronies in Iran, they they have to deliver something against the United States, and even that only becomes, which they can't do, and even that only becomes an issue if they are happy to have their nation wiped out at the touch of a button. I mean, I am for an American government's maintaining overwhelming military force to defend this nation, and you know, nobody is stupid enough to try and lob one thing, even if they could get it here, one thing over to the United States and then be obliterated within 5 minutes. I mean, the whole thing is stupid. And if it wasn't stupid, then we should be sorting out North Korea. And these are, you know, we should be applying these same principles equally around the world. There's more threat from North Korea and its delivery capability than from Iran. I mean, this is the problem. It's the media gets an idea. You know, there's a flavor of the month, and then we start talking about whatever that is, and it's Iran, and then we talk it up and we make it into a thing. We make real what we focus on, and then we forget that the arguments that we make in one case, if we really mean them, we have to see what the world would look like if we applied them around the world. And when you try and do that mental exercise, you very quickly see the absurdity of many of the positions that are seriously being discussed right now and are seriously discussed in the media.
Well, to be perfectly fair also, there's a very strong Judeo-Christian tradition in this country, and that I think is where a lot of the attention on Iran is coming from, because of Iran's proximity to Israel and because of its relationships with Israel. I think that's probably what the real driving force is. North Korea doesn't really have that kind of relationship with Israel.
Well, you know, that's true, but, you know, that kind of touches on another point which Americans would do well to remember. When Iran becomes stronger, it affects not just the conflict that we perceive between Israel and, let's say, Muslims. It, strategically, the conflict between the Persians and the Arabs is at least as important. And here we are having a supposed discussion about, I mean the media of the United States, about Iran. And it seems to me they completely don't understand that.
Oh, you're exactly right there.
Yeah, with your background and, I guess, your recent travel back to the U.K., I was wondering if you could highlight for us, like, you know, the EU has been pressured mm-hmm. by the United States to stop the purchase of oil, really an economic embargo to try and bring Iran to the so-called bargaining table on something that they're just flat out saying that they aren't even pursuing. I was wondering, could you just summarize for us, like, what is mainland Europe's take on this whole Israel-Palestine Iran type situation? Because here in the U.S., as Walt was saying, it's overall, you know, most of the politicians are pro-Israel. It's almost like Israel's the 51st state.
But, right. Yeah, no, right. I mean, that let's say, special relationship with Israel is obviously something peculiar to the United States. And depending on where you go in Europe, sympathies may lie more on one or the other side of the Arab-Israeli conflict. But there's certainly not the kind of obsession with the question. There certainly isn't a feeling that Israel is in some way an extension of, you know, anybody's national identity in Europe. And that's also, I think, largely related to the fact that we don't have anywhere in Europe now a politically strong, hard religious right. I think those things are related. Although I should say, the best way to answer your question would actually be to go and visit watchingamerica.com, which I run when I'm not talking about Ron Paul, where we translate foreign news and views about the U.S. and all U.S.-related issues and foreign policy from around the world. So if you actually go to the watchingamerica.com homepage now, you and over the next few days and weeks, you will see articles written, in some cases, by Israelis and Iranians, but also by people in countries throughout the world, about including in Europe, about this very issue. And I don't have time to read all of the articles that go up on my website, watchingamerica.com. So I would just point your listeners to that site, I think.
Robin, a question about Blue Republicans, and then I have to apologize. I was realizing that before the break, during the promo, I announced you as Blue Democrats, and I feel like I should be kicking myself. But Blue Republicans, since the concept has evolved, and you got the Facebook page up, you got the website up, you had an initial surge. What's happened since then, and what are your plans for the election season?
Things are feeling really good with respect to Blue Republicans. I'm getting more interviews now than ever. I'm getting lecture requests. I'm going to be talking to the Republicans in Idaho at the end of this month. I'm going to be giving a lecture at Boise State University there in Idaho, you know, with a view, obviously, to having some impact on the caucus. Had an interest from the University of California. It seems that this idea that we're kind of at the end of left versus right is really interesting to people on both the left and the right, or, you know, people who used to identify as Republicans and those who identified as Democrats. There's a lot of energy around this. I was very interested to see the exit poll results regarding who Ron Paul's was picking up, you know, whose votes he was picking up. He overwhelmingly has the independents, and he has the votes of people from 18 through their mid-30s.
Yeah, he had a
far
big,
ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, he absolutely clobbered Romney in that age group in New Hampshire. It was overwhelming, and in fact, from the numbers I saw, this came from Circle, who we had a guest of theirs on the show a couple weeks ago. Their numbers showed that in New Hampshire, the total number of youth actually was larger this year than in 2008 when they went out to support Obama. It wasn't a huge increase. It was a small increase. But nevertheless, there was an increase. And yet, at the same time, there was a percentage decrease. So in other words, the pure numbers were higher, but the percentage of the vote was lower, which means that there was more people who had registered to vote within that age group, but a smaller percentage were voting. Very interesting demographics breakdown that way.
Absolutely, and I think these hidden facts are really the most important facts in understanding where America is going. And I am very clear that it's going in what I call a blue Republican direction. You know, this notion that whether you believe in basically liberal principles or conservative principles, this growing idea that those principles have not been served well by traditionally Republican or traditionally Democrat means. So even liberals who, you know, I speak to a lot through the blue Republican idea, I think are waking up to the idea that social justice, economic justice haven't been served by centralized, government-enforced, large nationwide programs, for example. And so their minds are opening to this message of Ron Paul, which actually is very much a message of inclusivity, of live and let live. And as I've pointed out in one of my articles, it's kind of live and let love, because the one thing that you say to your loved ones is, you know, as you wish. You want for your loved ones what they want for themselves. And Ron Paul, as a political leader, is kind of saying to that as individual citizens of this nation. And that's a new way of doing politics, because it says it's not about trying to convince you of my vision and then getting the country to conform to it. And this is very exciting for young people who now have all of these, you know, means, the internet, through the internet mainly, of educating themselves at high speed about ideas that they may not have got at public schools, that they're not seeing in the media, that they're not hearing from the mainstream politicians. Blue Republican is on the rise. It's quite exciting. It's almost unbelievable how well we're doing. I'm having the time of my life right now.
Well, Robin, can I ask you, how does that translate to Europe as far as you mentioned the end of left and right and the liberty movement? Is that something that is going on in Europe too or not?
That is a great question. You know, one thing that's fascinating to me as a European, I come, obviously, you know, Europeans have this idea that Americans are kind of naive, right? They're very religious,
well, they're right.
So they can't be very politically mature. You know,
that's
they never
a nice
leave
way to
the country.
Put it.
Yeah, you know, they don't have passports, so they don't really know much about the world. So there is this kind of, you know, arrogance that many Europeans have towards America. But I now understand, having lived here for about 7 years, and it took me years to work this out, that philosophically, when it comes to politics. Americans are much more sophisticated than Europeans, because when Americans have political debates, they are almost invariably having philosophical debates. Now, in England, for example, which is the country in Europe closest to America culturally and in some ways politically, certainly institutionally, even at a general election, when we're electing the prime minister, which is obviously our nearest equivalent to a presidential election, we're never talking about tyranny or freedom. We're talking about, do we make the health service a lot bigger or just a little bit bigger? Right. It's very pragmatic. It's very incrementalist. So the Blue Republican idea is really a philosophical one. I mean, maybe this sounds a little overdramatic, but I'm trying to reframe all of American politics and recent American history, you know, in a way. I'm trying to explain it not in terms of Republican versus Democrat. I'm trying to say that misses the point, because they both represent wings of a political establishment that has civil rights issues, the same views on civil rights issues, monetary policy, so on and so forth. Now, Americans are waking up to that. We may not be where we need to be, but, you know, Ron Paul's 20-something percent show you that Americans are getting interested. The Europeans are behind the curve. Americans need to know that the biggest rise of tyranny in the world right now is the European Union. It's the massive concentration of political and economic power in the hands of a few in Europe. I would hope that Americans would be marching in the streets if this was being done to them. Well, it is kind of being done to them, and Americans are starting to march in the streets. I see that kind of anger and activism as being greater in the United States, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think, you know, on the 1st of December 2009, 27 sovereign nations in Europe were basically destroyed by the Lisbon Treaty, which was what they called the European Constitution. And nobody marched. I mean, these were the destruction of democratic nations. And nobody even really cared. So there's a great apathy in Europe. I see Europe is politically in decline. I'm not saying that Europe is a bastion of tyranny, but in terms of the direction it's going faster in that direction than anywhere else in the world. So things feel very different to me between Europe and the United States, and I'm pleased to be here and fighting this fight, because I believe the fight I'm fighting in the U.S., at least here, I've got a chance of having an impact. You know, I think we can make America the shining city on the hill again, because Americans kind of get the concepts that they need to get to make that possible.
Right, and with the whole mess with the euro, at least the UK took the step of vetoing the move towards a fiscal union over there in the Europe. But one last question for you, Robin, before we get going for a commercial break, and that's with the Blue Republicans. Is there any attempt to organize these people, individuals, as a group or an organization, or is it still kind of a grassroots type of deal?
No, it's definitely grassroots. But we are trying to support the effective organization of those grassroots. For example, BlueRepublican.org was specifically set up to explain that people can go to their state and see what they need to do to be able to participate in their state's caucus or primary, which they may well not know if they haven't been Republicans. You know, if they were independents or Democrats, when do they have to register by? When do they have to turn up? So I'm trying to make that information available. So we have the site bluerepublican.org to do that. We put a video out as well. You can get on YouTube. It's had tens of thousands of views about the process, just to inform people. Because with information, then it helps, obviously, people organize themselves more effectively. But I do see Blue Republican existing as an organization beyond the presidential election, whatever the outcome. I want to be at the spearhead of basically rethinking the American political paradigm.
Well, Robin, we'll have to follow you as you do that, because it sounds like you have quite a path laid out for you. Thanks for joining us on the program today, and we'll have you back again sometime.
Thank you, Jake. It was my pleasure, as always. Thank you.
And we will be back after these messages. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Yep, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And just to remind you, you can always check out the latest and greatest for the show at our website. That's www.freedomnewshour.com. And by the way, you can also leave comments about the various radio programs, particularly the recorded podcast from previous programs. In fact, one listener, John Murphy, did just that on the page about the interview with Dr. David Barker, former Federal Reserve economist, who appeared on the program December 1st. He had a book out called, what was the book called? I can't remember what it was called off the top of my head.
Welcome to Free America.
Welcome to Free America.
Like,
and John Murphy's comment was interesting. I thought I'd read it on the air. He said, David Barker's book is misnamed. He said the title should be Expensive America, because as soon as you replace government with the predators of the for-profit system, then prices explode to 2 to 5 times what they were when done by government. Just as an example, the American for-profit insurance-run healthcare system wastes 40% in overhead, in parentheses, profit and paperwork to deny people the healthcare they deserve, while Medicare has 3% overhead and Canadian healthcare, government-funded, physician-run, universal, covering every single president, resident of Canada, resident means both citizen and non-citizen, single-payer health system has 1.3% overhead. Medicare has 37% less overhead than American for-profit insurance-run health care, while private insurance is a death panel which kills 45,000 Americans each year. Canadian health care has 38.7% less overhead than American for-profit insurance-run health care, while private insurance is a death panel which kills 45,000. I think he just repeated his sentence. But finishing up, he says, predatory for-profit businesses are bad for the people of the United States and have no role in supplanting government. Government costs the American people 30% of what predatory for-profit businesses do. And I replied to him. I said, thanks for your comment. I said, I think your criticism of for-profit businesses misplaced, because if it were true, then no one from any business from a mom-and-pop operation on up should ever be permitted to earn a profit. This would effectively destroy the incentive people have to start businesses in the first place. It would also make it impossible for businesses to hire workers, because the only incentive would be to not lose money. And no one would want to work the long, hard hours necessary to build a successful business in order to accomplish nothing more than that. So what would be the point? The symptoms you are describing are actually not a function of the profit motive. Rather, they are a function of the monetary and banking system. So long as the monetary system continues to expand, the result is that more and more money gets poured into the hot industries, such as healthcare, which means that the companies in such an industry can be profitable without having to keep costs under control. Remove the expansive quality of the monetary system, and not only do you stop the flow of more money into that system, not only do companies develop an incentive to keep costs under control, but consumer costs actually come down. And as an afterthought to that, it should also be pointed out that most of the costs that would be involved in overhead with Medicare and with the government programs are actually passed along to the private sector and handled by the private sector, mainly the doctor's offices and the hospitals, who have to process all that paperwork for the federal government. So actually those numbers are a bit skewed, because the government basically gets away with passing along the overhead costs while actually having to report them on their bottom line. Jake, did you have anything you wanted to add on that one?
No.
Okay. I wanted to go next to Gene's story. Gene, you have a very interesting take on what's going on with credit cards, and why don't you give us the details on that?
Yeah, it looks like Americans are back to their old habits. The study was done on November, and it says the U.S. consumer borrowing rose by the most in a decade during November, surging 10%, with Americans pulling out their credit cards basically for the holiday season. The level of consumer credit outstanding increased by $20.37 billion to $2.478 trillion, that Federal Reserve reported on Monday. Economists surveyed by Dow Jones Newswires had forecast an $8 billion increase. So they were off a little bit. In percentage terms, the increase was the biggest since October 2001, and a big driver of the gain was revolving credit, which includes credit card debt. It increased by $5.6 billion to almost $800 billion. Non-resolving credit also surged, rising almost $15 billion to $1.679 trillion. The increase was fueled by federal government, a category that includes student loans and has been increasing a lot over the past year, a sign that high joblessness in the U.S. has led many people to go back to school. The November jump in consumer credit followed a gain of $6 billion during October and was the 13th increase in 14 months, so people are starting to pull out their credit cards. Rising credit can be a sign people are more comfortable with the economy, or an indication they are forced to finance essential purchases such as food and gasoline. The big gain in revolving credit during November suggests consumers use credit cards to buy gifts, etc. Consumer spending has been growing, but not very fast. Well, inflation isn't out of control, according to this thing. The lackluster economy that is restraining prices has also kept income gains small. Over the past year, the rate Americans save money has slid considerably, with the latest government figures showing it at 3.5% in November compared to 5.1% in November of 2001. And that's an interesting statistic, because since the economic crisis, I'm pretty sure the rate has been real close to 5%, which was up. I think before the crisis, the savings rate was around 2%. And the economists, many economists actually looked at that as a positive thing, which it seems that it is. And it kind of seems like people are, even though they're not, they're in pretty bad shape, they're pulling out the credit cards again.
It would have been interesting to hear if they'd actually correlated how much of that increase in credit usage was directly correlated to the Christmas holidays, because obviously the holiday spending was a little bit better than expected this year. I wonder if it was because people were putting it on their credit card.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there, and I think that's right, because it was better than last year, and I think, you know, that'd be a good study to take how much did the credit increase last year in November as opposed to this year, because it just seems like it was better just because of the credit, which, of course, has to be paid at some point. So.
Yeah, that's always a tough part, isn't it? Because
it is a tough part.
The banker always gets the last laugh.
He does.
Except when the banker works for the U.S. government, because as you may or may not have heard, the Federal Reserve made their annual payment to the U.S. Treasury of roughly 95% of everything that the Federal Reserve makes. That's what the arrangement is. The U.S. Treasury gets the profits, so to speak, or at least the recorded profits that totaled $77 billion that the Fed paid to the Treasury this year. Unfortunately, $77 billion doesn't even make a dent in all the money that's been created out of thin air. But, hey, Jake, at least they're giving a little bit of it back. What do you think?
Well, that's the way it's kind of always been. But, you know, it just kind of highlights that there's a shell game going on with the purchases of the government debt by the Fed. You know, why is it even, someone that just heard of this would be like, well, why the heck would they do something like that? And, you know, the answer is, of course, is that what that does is it sets off a massive credit expansion throughout the entire banking system. But, and it leads also to the Congress being able to freely spend, whether it's on wars or entitlement spending. And today also President Obama sent notice to the Congress, official notice, that government needs another $1.2 trillion in borrowing authority. So that would then raise the debt ceiling to $16.4 trillion. That starts a 15-day clock for Congress to consider and vote on a joint resolution to either approve or disapprove of the increase. So we're just what we did in August. It looks like it's going to come up again.
Over and over again. Yeah.
So let's get this straight. Since they increased the debt ceiling, we're now needing another $1.2 trillion increase. That's over the course of, what, 7 months?
Well, what they ended up doing in August, in classic U.S. Congress fashion, is they decided that they were going to delegate to the super committee, and then in the meantime,
oh, okay,
extended by $300 billion or $500 billion or $500 trillion or some number like that. The super committee, of course, completely failed, and what was supposed to happen is massive cuts were supposed to start kicking in. Of course, they haven't. Because nobody wants that to happen. And I think that, you know, we're just going to have another set of debates, and probably the White House wants to get this debate over and done with well before the elections, while the Republicans probably want to stretch it out all the way until, October. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Of course, really, when it all boils down, both parties are expanding the debt ceiling. One of them might say no, but that's only because the other one's in power.
Well, I think there's actually an alternative explanation for all of this, and we can basically just wipe everything aside that we've said so far, because here's what's really driving the whole thing. What's driving it is that they're all high. They are all smoking pot like crazy. And to carry on that theme, Gene, give us the details on why pot smoking is not so bad for you.
Maybe they all should be. There was a study done, University of California at San Francisco, of course, and it basically came out, we've always heard, and I remember hearing that smoking marijuana actually was worse than cigarette smoke, but it came out and said smoking a joint from time to time won't damage the lungs even after years of drug use. And it disproves one of the major concerns about marijuana, that smoking it would be just as risky as lighting up a cigarette. The study, results of which were published Tuesday in the Journal of American Medical Association, found that the lung capacity of people who smoke marijuana was not diminished by regular toking, even among those who smoked once or twice a week. And I can skip ahead because I have actually read this. They actually found that those who smoked once or twice a week had a greater lung capacity than the average person. And they went on to say only heavy marijuana users, those who smoked 20 or more joints a month, saw a negative impact on the pulmonary system, but that level of marijuana use is unusual. In fact, they said it may be that marijuana smoke doesn't affect lung function the way tobacco does, simply because people don't smoke as many joints as they do smoke cigarettes.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there, but I think the conclusion there, it really comes down to whether or not you're in Congress, because if you're in Congress, you have the lung power so you can handle all of this. And guys, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll catch you next week, but it's been a pleasure as usual.
All right.
Yeah, stay free, everyone.
And we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.